Hello and welcome back. You're listening to Paleocast. I'm Dave Marshall, and today's episode is one that will really get you thinking. I'll be talking to Nick Longrich of the University of Bath, all about a really peculiar group of animals. They look like worms, but are in fact lizards. They're worm lizards. But before we get into the episode, we've first got to talk about our art competition. We had 73 submissions in total, which was far beyond anything we'd expected to get. So a big thank you to all those who entered, and also to all those who voted. We loved each and every one of the pieces submitted, but we only had prizes for three. So, our winners. In the under-16 category, the prize went to Jonas Hackens for his depiction of Nothronicus disguised as a cycad. In the over-16 category, David Clark wins for his Mississippian brittle star, Onycaster, on an Acronites stem. And the first prize, taken in a massive 401 votes, goes to Francisco Blanco for his Permian mosaic. So, congratulations to those three, and hopefully we'll bring the competition back next year, even bigger and better than ever. So, to worm lizards, Amphisbaenians. I had never heard of them, but now we're going to be told a fascinating story about how these legless, burrowing predators were able to cross oceans to populate new continents after their end Cretaceous mass extinction. A shout out goes to both Paul O'Connor Pryor and Patrick Kennedy for getting in touch, and we hope they and you listening enjoy this interview. So Nick, thank you very much for having me here at Bath. Can we start off by telling us how you got into paleontology and became a paleontologist?
I always knew I'd be a paleontologist. I've always been interested in nature. I was, of course, interested in dinosaurs as a kid, but there's nothing really unique about that. But I was just sort of interested in nature in general. I grew up in Alaska, right on the coast, and so I'd go tide pooling when I was a kid and go over and go down to the tide pools and flip over rocks and look for octopi and crabs and go up in the mountains and look for flowers, collected insects. I was kind of unhappy that we didn't have a great insect diversity. We had absolutely no herpetology up there, so no lizards and no amphibians.
I bet you had mosquitoes.
A few, yeah. They could be bad in the summer. So I was just kind of interested in nature in general. And I think in high school I got interested in evolution and paleontology by reading books about it, popular books, things like, I think, Gould's Wonderful Life and his essays, Jared Diamond, and of course, things like Dinosaur Heresies and Predatory Dinosaurs of the World. And they got me really excited about paleontology and about trying to understand how these extinct animals lived and how they evolved into things like birds. And so that was sort of the start of my interest in paleontology.
So now you'd be a specialist on vertebrates and, in particular, squamates?
I specialize in vertebrates, and I, unlike a lot of people, I don't really have a particular group I work on. I've worked on birds, on dinosaurs, now on squamates. I find that it's, for me, very educational to work on different groups of things, and it's just kind of a way of keeping things interesting instead of getting locked into one particular taxon. I just like to go wherever there's an interesting question. And I guess I'd rather work on some people get very, very fascinated with one particular group. Like they want to work on dinosaurs and of course theropod dinosaurs. And I'm interested in the question. And I always say I'd rather work on instead of working on a boring dinosaur, I'd rather work on something else that's exciting. And so the fossil, if it has something interesting to tell us, an interesting story, I don't really care if it's a bird, a dinosaur, a lizard, a snake, whatever. And a lot of these things do have interesting stories if you know how to look at them.
So what we're going to be looking at today is the radiation of animals after the end Cretaceous extinction event. But first, can you paint a picture for us of what the Cretaceous world was like?
Sure. So it's a very different world than we have today. On land, the dominant land animals are dinosaurs. There are a lot of mammals, very high mammal diversity, but they're not modern mammals. They're archaic mammals. Lizards and snakes are around at this time period. In the oceans, we have things like mosasaurs and plesiosaurs are the dominant marine vertebrates. a lot of archaic teleost fishes. In the skies, we have archaic birds and pterosaurs. And then, you know, almost all of these things vanish virtually overnight.
So what happened?
Well, an asteroid impact happened. And, you know, a lot of people say, well, you know, that couldn't possibly, just one thing like an asteroid impact couldn't do it. But we're talking about, you know, I think it's like 100 billion megatons of TNT equivalent is the energy release of, you know, the Chicxulub impact. It is the largest asteroid impact in the history of the planet. And I sat down and calculated it, and it basically gave every single person on Earth their own Hiroshima-sized nuclear device, and they all blew them up simultaneously. That is the energy release we were talking about. It was a Holocaust. And, you know, the after effects were catastrophic. And you don't really need anything else to explain, you know, a mass extinction in this event.
But was it just the fiery inferno, or how long did the extinction actually take?
It probably wasn't really a fiery inferno. It's not like kind of, it's more kind of gloom and doom than fire and brimstone. And so there's been some debate about whether there might have been a pulse of heat release. So basically this ejecta is shot up into space and it comes back down. And as it comes through the atmosphere, it reenters, it heats up. And some of that heat would be released, and possibly people would argue it'd be enough to start wildfires. That's debated. No one's actually sure if that's the case. There is evidence from soot at the KT boundary, but it does not appear to be derived by the burning of terrestrial matter. There's no real evidence of charcoal in the case of forest fires. And certainly over large swaths of the planet, you'd have cloud cover, and that would intercept that thermal radiation. So the idea of burning everything off, it's conceivable, but there's no real strong evidence for it. The primary kill mechanism is probably the interception of solar radiation by debris shot into the atmosphere. And this is going to create a period of darkness and cooling. How long is kind of up for debate, and how dark it got, I don't know if we're quite certain on that. But probably a period of at least several months where it's too dark for photosynthesis. And several months without food is a long time for most species. And a lot of the debris might have fallen out relatively quickly within a matter of, you know, weeks to months. Most of the debris is gone, but there is the possibility that sulfates are being released from the target rocks, which include a lot of gypsum, I believe. And the sulfates released by the impact could potentially stay up there for years. So it might be very, very dark for a brief period, but then you'd have this dim period that would go on for a period of years. But most of the extinction was probably over within a matter of years, geologically instantaneous. It was happening fast enough, we can't actually track it in the fossil record. So less than 10,000 years is, we can say for certain. How long, I'd speculate months to years, most of the extinctions were over.
Do we have any evidence from the geology of the ash layer? Because we have an iridium anomaly.
Yeah. So what we have is, I mean, there is the KT boundary is the record of impact. It is the debris layer from this gigantic asteroid impact, and it has lots of indicators of an asteroid impact. The iridium layer is kind of the most obvious one. The iridium was the thing that kind of kicked it all off. But it contains spherules, which are these microscopic beads of rock that's been melted and then recondensed. So it's rock melted, shot into the atmosphere, and forms these little BBs, and then it rains down. And you also get shock impact, shock deformed quartz, which is a metamorphic rock that forms only in asteroid impact craters and in nuclear blast sites. And this shock deformed quartz is found in the KT boundary. We also have the crater itself. And then there's a huge tsunami debris layer that's around the Gulf of Mexico that's evidence of impact. So there's tons and tons of evidence of impact. That's not why we think the KT extinction wiped out the dinosaurs, though. So just saying there's an impact, that's what the geologists can tell us that. It doesn't necessarily follow that the impact caused the extinction. The really compelling piece of the puzzle is that the fossils. The fossils tell us that the ecosystem fell apart precisely at the KT boundary, precisely with the deposition of this iridium layer. You can track a characteristic biota, Cretaceous biota, exactly up to the iridium layer, within a few millimeters, if you're looking at, say, pollen or nanofossils in marine ecosystems. And they tell us that the ecosystem was doing pretty well. It was more or less stable up the moment of impact, and then everything fell apart. And so that is why we can be so confident that Chicxulub was the driver of the extinction.
If we can talk about the selection of the organisms that survived, were these particularly hardy ones, or were they in a certain geographical area and the whole population survived?
It's probably a bit of both. So one thing we found consistently is that widespread species tend to do better. And partly they might be more adaptable in terms of able to exploit a wider range of food items, tolerate a wider range of climates, but partly it's going to be being in the right place at the right time. And in terms of where the right place might be, there is some evidence that high latitude environments, at least in the oceans, tended to act as refugia. So they were probably more adapted to seasonal shutdowns of productivity. So when you have this period of not much food entering the ecosystem for a few months or years, they're probably better adapted to that. So that's one possibility. Another thing that's very, very striking is that particular types of animals tended to survive. On land, small insectivorous things, like pretty much everything below 5 kilograms went, everything above 5 kilograms was wiped out. Most and almost everything below 5 kilograms, but at least if you were below 5 kilograms, you had a fighting chance. And if you're an insectivore or an omnivore, you tended to do pretty well. Another very striking feature of the selectivity is freshwater animals tended to do pretty well. So there is extinction at the species level for things like crocodilians and turtles, but it's not a real game changer for these animals. And so if you go back to the late Cretaceous, you know, the Hell Creek Formation, Lance Formation, Dinosaur Park Formation in Western North America, and you look at the freshwater animals there, a lot of these things are things that are still around today. Things like snapping turtles, softshell turtles, gars, bowfin, alligators. And so you have a situation where the terrestrial fauna in these assemblages looks radically different from what we have today. The dinosaurs, of course, no longer here. But the turtle fauna and alligator fauna and fish fauna is not quite as different. And that reflects the fact that there was an extinction, but it wasn't a mass extinction game changer for the freshwater ecosystem. So, you know, there seems to be a number of different ways to survive. Being widespread seemed to help, being small seemed to help, being insectivore helped on land, being aquatic seemed to really help. And I think my other sense is that being a specialist in the right way, specializing on a particular niche, was a good thing. Like if you were a specialist fish eater, you did well. If you're a specialist mollusk eater, you probably did well. So not so much generalist versus specialist as specializing in the right niche. And also physically being in the right place.
So the group of animals you've been looking at recently are the squamates, as we said. Who are included in this?
Okay, so the squamates include the lizards, the snakes, and the worm lizards. And this is a pretty diverse group today with about 10,000 living species.
Is a worm lizard just a mix between a snake and a lizard?
No, it is a separate, independent evolution of a long-bodied body plan from a lizard ancestor. And snakes are highly modified limbless or largely limbless lizards. And this is actually something squamates have done repeatedly. I think over a dozen times they've evolved these very long-bodied forms with reduced limbs, this kind of snake-like plan. The snakes are the far and away the most successful this has happened many times, and it's been most successful in the snakes, but the amphisbians might be a close second in terms of the success of this basically worm-like body plan in the lizards.
So the amphisbians are the worm lizards?
The amphisbenia are the worm lizards.
Right, okay. And are snakes a monophyletic group, meaning that they all form like one lineage, opposed to just a big paraphyletic or polyphyletic group, which is kind of all things that sort of look
same. So there's lots of different types of legless lizards out there, long-bodied legless lizards. There's California legless lizard, which is an alligator lizard. Slow worm, which is another type of alligator lizard, not related to California legless lizard. And there's the amphisbenians. There's the snakes. There's the pygopods, which are legless geckos. And there's some legless skinks. And dibanids. So this has happened multiple times. The snakes are, however, unique in taking this long-bodied plan and evolving, becoming highly specialized for carnivory. And they basically go below ground, become specialized for that, and then come above ground and start eating things. The amphisbenians never really, they basically stay below ground. They stay highly committed to this fossorial mode of life.
So how did the whole group fare over the end Cretaceous mass extinction?
So the Squamates as a whole seem to really get hit hard. And the conventional wisdom is that there was relatively little extinction of the Squamates across the KT boundary. So we have lizards back then, we have lizards today, we have snakes back then, snakes today. And the niches that are occupied before and after are grossly similar. You have carnivorous and herbivorous lizards before, carnivorous and herbivorous ones afterwards. But if you get in there and look at the details, what we find is that a lot of the things that were assigned to modern groups from the Cretaceous period are actually members of extinct groups that go extinct at the KT boundary. And so based on my work in the western interior of North America, there's a massive extinction of the lizards and snakes at the KT boundary. We found about 85% extinction at the species level. So, and that includes entire families of lizards and snakes, including the dominant family of lizards at the time. There's these lizards called polyglyphanodonts, and we don't really know what they are. They might be related to whiptail lizards. They might be related to iguanas. They might be something else entirely. But they're kind of like the big lizard group in the Cretaceous period. They're really thriving. And there's also a carnivorous group that's kind of like their sort of proto-monitor lizards. And these things are both wiped out. And there's also a big carnivorous snake, and it vanishes. So there's a massive extinction of the lizards at the KT boundary. And lizards and snakes do well across the KT boundary compared to dinosaurs, compared to the non-avian dinosaurs, which are completely wiped out. I mean, anything is better than that. So, you know, if you grade it on a curve, yeah, they do well. But in absolute terms, they really get hit hard. And I think that's characteristic of pretty much everything across the KT boundary and terrestrial ecosystems. I don't think really anything was spared. This is a global extinction event. Something sufficiently severe to wipe out all the dinosaurs. There's no way you have this giant asteroid impact. You wipe out all the dinosaurs, and it's not having a hell of a lot of other casualties as well. And lizards and snakes were one of these groups that got hit really hard as well, even though some of those lineages survived and managed to diversify afterwards.
So that diversification after the extinction event, was it gradual, or did it really explode into all the vacant niches?
We don't really know what's going on with the lizards over the KT boundary. We don't really have... The record is not as good as mammals because their teeth aren't and jaws aren't quite as durable. It's not as thoroughly studied as mammals. But my guess would be there's probably a sudden explosion. There's a sudden burst of radiation of lizards across the KT boundary. And some of those lineages would have made it, and some of them wouldn't have. We tend to focus on the winners when we look at the KT recovery. So we'll go back and look and say, oh, yeah, primates. Well, primates are evolving, and bats and whales. We focus on these things. But because we're interested in the origins of modern groups, but there's also all these other groups out there at the same time that are radiating that don't survive. And, you know, teenyodont mammals, for example. No one's really writing Nature and Science papers about teenyodonts because they didn't make it. And I think kind of the dirty secret about these recoveries is most of the lineages that appear in the immediate after recovery probably don't make it until today. There's a lot of things that are radiating and experimenting, and either they're outcompeted by other lineages that are becoming established at the time, or there are other extinction events over the course of the Cenozoic that take them out. My guess is that something similar might be going on with lizards and snakes, but we really don't understand the patterns well enough. The evidence we have from the Amphisbaenians, however, is that for this particular group, there does seem to be an explosive radiation in the aftermath of Chicxulub.
And is that why you've chosen to study this group?
It was sort of an accident, actually. So I was studying, you know, small vertebrates across the KT boundary, and at the time, I was trying to study some salamanders and ended up not pursuing it because salamander species are really, really hard to tell apart. But in the process, I was going through this little box of bones from the Paleocene period, earliest Paleocene, and I pulled this tiny little jaw out of it, and I looked at it and I said, well, that doesn't look like a salamander at all. That looks like that looks kind of like a lizard, except it's really, really small. It's really, really short, very deep, and only has like about 9 teeth in the jaw. And it just immediately hit me that I'd seen a similar jaw morphology in the Amphisbaenians. So it was stumbling, and it turned out to be the oldest definitive Amphisbaenian known, by only about 2 million years, but still the oldest. And it's also, it's just above the KT boundary. It's in a you know, it's in a rock layer that's deposited within a few tens of thousands of years of the Chicxulub impact. And so it's the oldest known amphibian. It's appearing immediately above the boundary. And I just started getting interested in this group and understanding their evolution and because of this jaw. And so it led to this bigger study where we looked at, you know, more fossils, but also, you know, the molecular biology of the group and their molecular clock.
So did we get the worm lizards fossils before the end Cretaceous?
There are actually no worm lizard fossils known from the Cretaceous. The group appears immediately after the asteroid impact. I mean, we're talking within a couple tens of thousands of years. There just isn't time for them to evolve from lizards into worm lizards in that time period, is my sense of things. So that's extremely unlikely. And they're not the only group that does this. I mean, the earliest known primates appear almost, you know, within a couple hundred thousand years of the KT impact. And they're probably not evolving in 200,000 years. I mean, they're not, unless they're showing viral rates of evolution. And more likely what happens is these groups that suddenly appear in the aftermath of the extinction are, their competitors and predators have been wiped out and they're expanding into new areas. And so that's why they suddenly appear in the fossil record. So amphisbians are probably there in the Cretaceous period, but they're confined to some habitat, maybe somewhere in southern North America, where it doesn't fossilize. And likewise, the primates are probably hanging out somewhere in Asia where we don't have good fossil record and confined to these small niches. So this is kind of a theme, is a lot of things seem to appear out of nowhere after the asteroid impact. And it's not that they weren't there, since they're confined to small niches where we're not seeing them in the fossil record. We don't have their fossils. And then suddenly when, you know, the kind of the dinosaurs are away, everybody comes out and has a big party and these groups become widespread. And then they show up in the fossil record. So I think a lot of these things are sort of waiting in the wings. They're kind of lurking in the background, waiting for their big moment, and the asteroid impact lets them have it. And so suddenly we start finding these things. And we see the same pattern with families of amphibians, families of lizards, families of snakes, families of mammals, where they just suddenly appear in the aftermath of the extinction.
You've been looking at the paleobiogeography of worm lizards.
Yeah.
So first question, what is the paleobiogeography like immediately after?
Yeah.
And then second question is, without any fossils before the extinction, how can you use the worm lizards to be able to say anything about the paleogeography? Because they could have just been everywhere.
Yeah. So what we're finding based on the fossil record is they go from basically having no fossil record in the Cretaceous period. There is a form from Mongolia that's been called a worm lizard, but I think more recently people have disputed that. So basically no definitive evidence of worm lizards. So all of a sudden, they're there in North America, immediately above the boundary. By the early Eocene, we have several different families that are appearing in North America. And then in the Paleocene, they pop up in Europe and also in North Africa. So they go from being not found anywhere to being on three separate continents in the span of about 10 million years. And based on the phylogeny, we have the most primitive things coming out of North America. So our best guess is they evolved in North America and then became geographically widespread after the KT extinction. Now there is this issue of, you know, does the is their absence outside of North America before the KT boundaries, that's just a sampling thing. So what we did is we looked at the molecular clock of these guys. We were able to compare the DNA sequences of modern worm lizards. And based on the idea that the more different the DNA is, the more evolutionary time separates these any two lineages, we were able to try and calculate the divergence time for the modern lineages. And what we found is that the divergence time for the modern lineages is almost smack dab on top of the KT boundary. KT's at 66, the modern worm lizards split apart at around 65 million years ago based on our models. So the implication is if they only evolved at 65 million years ago, they have to become widespread since then. And their sudden appearance in the Paleocene of Europe and the Paleocene of Africa is reflecting, is a real pattern and not simply an artifact of sampling.
Are you able to reconstruct how they dispersed geographically?
So it's kind of not that we have any positive evidence, but rather we have negative evidence. So there's a line, I think it's out of Sherlock Holmes, but some people may remember it from when it's quoted by Spock in Star Trek, he says, you know, when you eliminate the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, is the truth. And so the original theory was that these worm lizards do not have great dispersal potential because they're subterranean animals. They're small worm-like burrowers. They virtually never come out of their burrows, which is why most people have never even seen one. And they're probably not moving long distances. So the most likely explanation people thought was they're a really, really ancient group. They go back to when all the continents were united, back in the days of Pangaea, and just kind of burrowed from one end to the other of Pangaea. Pangaea splits apart, and that's how they reach their modern distribution on many different continents. It's very plausible. The problem is that the timing doesn't work. Pangaea starts splitting up around 200 to 180 million years ago, and the worm lizards are a far more recent radiation. The oldest worm lizards might have originated in the early Cretaceous, but the main pulse of diversification, the group that's widespread today, only evolves at 65 million years ago. And the final breakup of Pangaea, the fragmentation of between Africa and South America, happens at 100 million years ago. So fragmentation is over at 100 million years ago, and this group doesn't even get started until 65 million years ago. There's got to be some other way that these things are moving. Now, there is a high-latitude land bridge between North America and Europe, but it's pretty cold in the Paleocene, and these guys don't like cold. They're a subtropical lineage. The furthest north you'd get them would be, you know, southern Spain, Florida, Baja California. They don't like cold temperatures. They have to live where the ground is warm because they're cold-blooded and they can't emerge to bask for heat. And so they can't live at high latitudes. They can't take this high-latitude northern route into Europe, most likely. So they're probably... they've got to make an ocean crossing. And they're getting into Africa, and there's no land connection between Africa and Europe, so that's got to be an ocean crossing. They later get from Africa into South America, and that's got to be an ocean crossing. And then they're all through the Caribbean, and most of those islands have never had any land connection. So all of this tells us these things can, in fact, cross water. So, you know, we just have no alternative. We've eliminated continental drift. We've eliminated land bridges. The only way to get them to their modern distribution in the time scale that that the evidence says that they got there is they've got a raft across oceans.
I like the idea of the ejecta from the Chicxulub impact just raining down worm lizards.
Well. I think it's an interesting idea, but unlikely they would survive the transport. I mean, if they're close enough to be carried in the ejecta, I think the shockwave would just kill them. But anyway, it's possible. I mean, there might be microbes or something that could be dispersed in this fashion. I don't know. Rafting seems to be the answer.
Right. So we don't have any of the rafts preserved, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And I've never seen a floating bit of land when I've been out walking on the beach.
Yeah.
How common can these be?
I don't think they're terribly common. I've never seen one either. I have talked to a colleague at the Natural History Museum, and he says he's seen these things adrift in the Amazon River during a big flood. You'll see just chunks of vegetation swept off, roots and soil and all drifting away. And there is actually a report, I think it was published in either Nature or Science, of a successful rafting event where a whole raft of debris swept offshore by a hurricane came ashore on one of the Caribbean islands with a contingent of iguanas. Several dozen iguanas were carried across the ocean successfully and made and colonized an island. So it does happen. Is it common? No. But the thing is, it's you know, so getting back to the you know, eliminating the impossible, rafting is very, very improbable. But improbable is very, very different from impossible. And things that are improbable over a short time period, like a human lifespan, become very, very probable over a long time period, if we're talking about millions of years. So an event that's so unlikely it only happened once every million years would pretty much by definition happen dozens of times over the course of the Cenozoic. So I think that's the thing is, and you know, we talk a lot about the present being the key to the past, but the present in terms of our lifespan is a few decades. And in terms of human history, written history is, a couple millennia. There are events that are very, very rare that we just don't see them because we don't live long enough. And human civilization hasn't been here long enough to record them. But these events may in fact be important. And things, asteroid impacts are one of these. The reason why, if you just go out and look around today, you see events like, erosion and climate change and the rise and fall of continents. And if this is all you have to go on, you assume this is the driver of evolution. But if you actually had the ability to sit there and watch the planet over the course of millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of years, you start seeing extraordinarily rare events, things like, massive volcanic eruptions, ice ages, and asteroid impacts coming into play. So, I think the history of Earth is to a large degree, there are these extraordinarily unlikely, rare, improbable events, but given a long enough time period, and this is the whole thing about deep time, is really improbable things that we don't see operating today can operate over these timescales. And asteroid impact is one of them, and rafting is one of them. So it seems impossible, but it seems to have happened.
So it did happen. And here we have worm lizards arriving on a new continent in a vacant niche. Did they go through independent radiations from that point, and each group on its new continent go off in its own evolutionary trajectory?
Yeah, basically what happens is you get a series of radiations. The North American worm lizards occupy a fair number of niches. The European ones might have been more diverse in the past than they are today, but they're not terribly diverse today. But once they get into Africa, they really kind of go nuts in terms of... they're all subterranean burrowers eating small invertebrates in underground, but they have radically different burrowing styles. So the ancestral burrowing style is these guys have kind of a rounded head, and they just sort of ram it into the soil to create a burrow. But then some of them evolve a specialized shovel-shaped head, and they can kind of shovel the sand or shovel the dirt to create their burrows. And others evolve this kind of plow-shaped head, and they can kind of move it side to side to create the burrows. And they appear to have distinct ways of moving. And they evolve all these different ways of moving underground in Africa. Then one lineage, which has a round head, manages to successfully disperse from Africa into South America, and they recreate the same range of shapes. So you have, the ancestral round-headed Amphisbaenian, but then the South American group also produces these shovel-headed and plow-headed forms. So they have these major radiations going on in Africa and in South America. And they kind of tend to evolve in the same way in each ecosystem.
And you can definitely say that they came from a round-headed ancestor, and not just the multiple rafting events with each of the different head shapes got there.
Yeah. So all of the based on the molecular evidence, all of the African things come from a single ancestor, which was probably round-headed, as far as we can tell, and. All of the South American things seem to come from a single ancestor, which probably was round-headed, and then independently evolve these different ecomorphs. So they tend to jump from one continent to another, diversify, jump from that continent to another, diversify, and just keep doing this. And they've been doing it for a long time and fairly successfully.
Do you think this rafting hypothesis can be used to explain the distribution of a whole range of other organisms?
I think it's the rule, and not. I think dispersal is the rule and not the exception. Either by land bridges or by rafting is the main mechanism driving the distribution of modern species. I think continental drift might work for certain groups of animals that are extraordinarily ancient and which managed to do well over the KT boundary. Their modern distribution might be well explained by continental drift, and so. The presence of lungfish in South America and in Africa, could potentially be due to this. The turtles and turtle distributions might be, turtles are very ancient and they might be, their distribution might well be explained by continental drift. The issue is that most groups of organisms, and especially diverse groups of organisms, are recent radiations. And that's because of the KT boundary. So modern mammal diversity is originates at the KT boundary. They're part of a post-KT radiation, a series of radiations of surviving mammals. Same thing with birds. The vast majority of modern bird diversity occurs after the KT boundary. I suspect that's the case for lizards. I suspect that's the case for most organisms. And so most lineages of organism only go back about 66 million years ago. And continental drift is continental breakup is done at 100 million years ago. So I think for the most part, dispersal and not continental drift is the primary mechanism behind the distribution of living animals. And in this sense, I think worm lizards are not an exception. I think they're kind of a model for understanding how species move around the planet. And, you know, we've seen similar cases in other animals. Iguanas, modern iguanas, seem to originate after the KT boundary. There are iguanas in mostly in North and South America, but there doesn't appear to have been a land connection between North and South America, so they probably dispersed from North America into South America one or more times over water. Then some of them end up in Madagascar, and that's been isolated for a very long time, so they must have rafted somehow from South America to Madagascar. There's one group of iguanas, one genus of iguana, that's all the way over in Fiji. So how the hell do you get iguanas from North America to Fiji? There's never been any iguanas, not modern iguanas, in Asia. The only way to get them there is they got a raft from the Americas, and it's just an insane distance across the Pacific to get to Fiji. And so this is within lizards, and then there's groups of snakes that appear to, you know, that disperse mammals. You know, monkeys seem to evolve in Africa, but there's a South American radiation, the South American monkeys, and they appear to get there about 40 million years ago. At the time, South America is isolated. It's an island continent. The only way for monkeys to get there is to raft. Same thing with lemurs in Madagascar. There's a South American rodent radiation that, again, is linked to the African rodent. An African rodent radiation, they had to raft across the South Atlantic. So I think rafting is probably a lot more common than people think. And I think continental drift is rare. It's not that it never happens, but I think it's a pretty rare event, I think. I don't think it's the main mechanism behind modern biogeography. So it's kind of interesting, you know. Back when Darwin and Wallace were trying to figure out the distribution of modern species, they didn't know about continental drift. And the only mechanism they had to go on was land bridges and oceanic rafting. And so this is the hypothesis they put forward, is that modern distributions are explained by this mechanism. Then we discovered continental drift. And it seemed really intuitive, really obvious. Well, okay, if land masses used to be linked, we don't need to invoke land bridges. We don't need rafting. It was just this continental drift, these continents were all united, they fragmented, that explains everything. And it's really simple, it's really intuitive, but you know, a lot of hypotheses that are simple and intuitive and appealing aren't necessarily correct. And the issue is the timing just doesn't work. Most lineages are recent. Most lineages originated after the KT boundary, long after continental fragmentation has already taken place. So we go from this really intuitive, easy to understand explanation to this crazy, difficult to understand explanation of rafting. But it's, you know, this simple but impossible hypothesis versus this possible but really improbable hypothesis. And, you know, we're back where we started, back to the days of Darwin and Wallace. So it's kind of interesting, you know, science is not always progress. Sometimes, you know, just because, you know, the guys working back in the late 1800s, they were pretty smart, a lot of these guys. And sometimes we think we've moved on and, you know, we know so much better than they did. And then it turns out actually, we were wrong. Those guys working back in the Victorian age knew a few things and are worth listening to. And it's worth going back and reading their books.
So if rafting is the main dispersal mechanism, why is it that we have different floras and faunas in different continents? Wouldn't everything be totally cosmopolitan over a geological time? Or is it that the rates of evolution, you get more evolutionary events than you get rafting events?
I think it's, probably the latter is... they're rare events. So it's not like there haven't been, you know, to get a cosmopolitan fauna where, say, Africa and South America were very, very similar, you'd have to have very high rates of rafting, lots of successful rafting events crossing from one to the other. And that doesn't seem to be the case. So it happens, but it happens relatively rarely. So we know of two successful rafting events of mammals from Africa to South America, and that's the primates, South American monkeys, and then the rodents, the South American rodents. And so to get a very cosmopolitan fauna, you wouldn't need two, you'd need dozens and dozens of rafting events to basically get all the various African forms over to South America. And so it seems it happens, but doesn't happen often enough to create this faunal similarity. The other trick is that the type of things that can cross is probably fairly limited. Is large animals don't seem to make successful ocean crossings. It's mostly small things like rodents, things like small monkeys. And so it does happen. But what happens is, I think the other trick is that I think the probability of a successful dispersal changes over time. So the argument we make in the paper is that immediately after the KT, the odds of a successful colonization go up. So there's two things that have to happen for a successful colonization event. First of all, you have to successfully raft across the ocean. And that seems hard enough. Okay, you have to be blown, dozens or hundreds of miles or thousands of miles across an ocean on a small amount of vegetation, somehow make it to the other side, and either have a pregnant female or a viable population. And then it has to become established and not get wiped out. And that second part, that sounds like, oh, that's, okay, if you can make it, that's the hard part, is getting across the ocean. Not necessarily, because once you're on the other side, you've got predators, you've got competitors. There's this whole fauna that, is trying to basically eat you or compete with you for space. So not only do you have to get across the ocean, you have to then successfully establish yourself. And what I think happens is that once one lineage is the odds of successful colonization go up in the immediate aftermath of an extinction event because there's no competitors, there's no predators. So basically, when amphibians start rafting out of North America in the Paleocene into Europe, into Africa, there's nothing to compete with there. They basically land on virgin territory and they just kind of, there's all these open niches. There's an opportunity there. Once the recovery gets underway, increasingly niches are occupied. There's more competition, there's more predation. And so even though these rafting events might be going on constantly, the competition makes it very, very difficult for them to become established. And you can actually see this in operation with human populations. So, the Vikings, they successfully sailed across the North Atlantic and colonized North America, but the colonies didn't manage to establish themselves. And the reason why is that people had already gotten there, tens of thousands of years, thousands of years earlier with the Amerindians. They became successfully established in North America. And so when they arrived on the other side, they had people there they were fighting with. It made it a lot more difficult for their colonies to become established. And so it's kind of, I think, the same thing in the animal world. Is there's the physical barrier to colonization, but there's also this biotic barrier. And immediately after an extinction event, there's probably that biotic barrier, the competitors, the predators, is reduced. But then once things get in there, they kind of radiate and they fill all the available niches, and it becomes harder and harder to become established. So I think that's kind of part of it. That's one reason you don't get a more cosmopolitan fauna. Is there might be, maybe every few million years or every million years or so, a bunch of monkeys are blown across the South Atlantic into South America. But the first group in, they don't have any competitors. They become established. The next group in has to compete against an established species that are adapted to local habitat and are less likely to make that successful crossing.
Would you ever be able to experiment with this with some students, perhaps?
That's a great idea for a reality TV show. Just vote somebody off the island by pushing them over the side of the raft. I don't know. I thought it would be a really interesting experiment to track some of these rafts of vegetation. I've never seen one, but I've heard they're fairly common coming out of the Amazon. It'd be neat to put some GPS trackers on them and see what happens to them. And do any of them ever actually make it to Africa? and or probably the other way around. The prevailing currents probably. This is another striking feature: is a lot of the dispersal events seem to go in one direction. So there's a lot of dispersal from Africa to South America, but very little the other way around. So monkeys come from Africa to South America, rodents, Africa to South America, amphibians, Africa to South America, but very few South American taxa ever go back. And it seems to be the trade winds are going to push things from Africa to South America, not the other way around. So, yeah, so I don't know. It'd be interesting. It'd be interesting to try and track these, track some of these and see what happens. You know, nobody's really done much in terms of experimentation with dispersal. I mean, you know, some of that classic work was actually done by Darwin. He would take little, he would fill a bowl with salt water and then put seeds in there to see how long they could survive afloat in salt water and if they germinated afterwards. And he was one of the first people to actually experiment with this. What else? He would walk along the beach and he'd find trees and find bits of soil in their roots and pry the soil out and then see if he could get seeds in there that would germinate. And he did. So there has been some work done on this in the past, but not recently. But it'd be really cool too.
Well, Nick, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with Joe Keating, Laura Soule, and Liz Martin. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, with music supplied by the Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode and for our archive of past programs. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at @paleocast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.